I'm Dr. Kim Oberholzer, and I'd like to welcome you to the Grace Rock Ministry Podcast. I hope you enjoy today's lesson, and I would encourage you to visit our ministry website at www.gracerockministries.org to learn more. At the website, you'll learn more about Grace Rock and our reason for being, which is to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, to shepherd, mentor, and creatively communicate God's Word. In the meantime, sit back and relax and enjoy today's lesson. God bless. Okay, so this is going to be 1 and 2 Kings, week 1. This is the Bible history, and you've got one that is blank so you can write it, so you can help learn, you know, because when you write and learn. But you also have one that's filled in, so you don't have to freak out that you're not going to get all the notes. And we're only going to cover about half of it, because that's as far as we're going to get. So I want you to know where the kings fit in Old Testament history. This is I can teach the entire Old Testament in less than 20 minutes with this thing. A couple of resource pieces. Some of you always ask me, what would you read? I've got Tyndale has a small commentary. I think you can get them in separate pieces on Amazon. 1 and 2 Kings with Donald Weissman. Extremely good scholar and very easy to read. And then for Old Testament history, there's a variety of books. This is an older book, History of Israel by Davis and Whitcomb. This is the one I enjoy reading. Some of you know that I'm a brainiac, and so I've got some that I can read that the brainiac part of me likes, because it's got all the dates and the chronologies and the footnoting and all that stuff. This one's written to enjoy the Old Testament. And they do a great job with it. So if you want a book that covers the whole Old Testament, A History of Israel by Davis and Whitcomb. And this, as you can see, is my Macmillan Bible Atlas. It's about due for duct tape. I've had it since 1976. But I never read the Old Testament without opening my Bible Atlas. Because you do not know, and I do not know, where these places are. Well, you may not know. I've been to Israel 6 times. I know now. But I didn't know. And so when kings move and cities are attacked and the Shephelah and the plain and the Transjordan and all these things are mentioned, they're mentioned for a reason. Geography, how many of you have military background? A few. Geography plays a pretty key part in military procedure. So if you got ridge routes and mountains, there are certain places you can attack and certain places you can't attack. And all the cities are built on places of safety. And why would somebody build a city? What's the number one thing they're looking for when they build a city? Water. Yeah, you're in Israel. So a water supply and a place of safety are the two key things. And then a caravan or a travel, you know, an international travel route. There's two Kings Highways and a Transjordan. So anyway, if you don't have one of these, you need to find you one. Just go to a Bible bookstore and look around. Then go to Amazon and get it cheaper. Did I say that out loud? I can't believe I said that. I don't mind Bible bookstores, so you can go there and spend your money too. So if you have a Bible bookstore, I don't mean to offend you out there. Okay, anybody know what this picture is?
Yeah.
Masada. It was Herod's summer palace, so he could get out of the city. And it's a big, huge outcropping plateau. This is the Dead Sea back here. And this was a three-tiered temple at one time. You can see the columns. This is Roman mosaics down here and some of the plaster pillars. There's 6 major cisterns that I recall that hold about 600,000 gallons of water each. And so you could live there for quite some time. This was right here is the most ancient synagogue in Israel, first century synagogue. And I took a group of graduate students up there when I was teaching at Phoenix Seminary. And we sang praises to the Lord in the first Jewish synagogue. So I was like, boy. And also went underneath Jerusalem. Hezekiah's tunnel, which is kind of like underneath that they carved through and way back. And so as we go through the tunnel, we're singing hymns underneath Jewish Temple Mount. And then we got nabbed by certain individuals that help you out of the pool of Siloam. So when you get out, don't let them help you. They'll say, hey, let me help you, and they take your watch or your ring. So we, after the first trip, that never happened again. So anyway, what's interesting about this, when Israel, Jerusalem will fall in AD 70 to the Romans. It will be destroyed. The people will flee the city. And many of them will set up camp up here on top of Masada. And Flavius and the Romans will set up 12 Roman colonies around this and siege this thing. I'm thinking for 18 months. I'd have to look to be sure. This is part of a siege mound that they had built to get up to the top. There were 969, I believe, Jewish refugees up there at Masada, families, 12 elders among them. And at first, the Romans started building the siege wall. Of course, Israel never lacks for rocks. So there's a swimming pool up here. There's a hot room, a cold room, all these different things. They started throwing rocks at the Romans, and the Romans got knocked off the deal. So they went to Jerusalem, picked up captive Jews, and made the Jews build the siege wall so that their buddies up top would not throw stuff at them. Anyway, the day before they breached the final wall to come in and kill all of the families at Masada, the 12 elders, and there's a room right here, broke the pottery in 12 pieces and had numbers on them, and each elder was assigned different families to commit suicide with. And so when the Romans breached the wall, everybody was dead because they didn't want to give their children or their women or themselves to the Romans. And three people survived down in the cistern here, a lady and two children, a woman and two children. The point of Masada is this. When we talk about land, seed, and blessing with the nation of Israel, land is important to them. So when we hear them talk about the Golan Heights or the Gaza Strip or places like Masada, this is a holy place. They used to, they don't now. There's a 1,500-foot snake path that comes up the other side and comes up here. Or you can take the cable car. I take the cable car. But they would bring the new recruits for the Israeli army, the officers, to the top up here in a torchlight ceremony. And they would all swear that Masada would never fall again. So it's kind of like, if you're a Texan, the Alamo. That's liberty or death. And so that's how important land is in the nation of Israel. So we've got land galore. Israel doesn't. So when we hear them arguing over bits and pieces of settlements and communities, you've got to understand this is in their DNA from Abraham forward, the promise of being able to have this land one day. And they will when the Messiah comes back. So we're going to start with biblical history here. What's our first major event in the Bible? Okay, this is what we call kinesthetic learning. You do it with me. We'll all try to do this together. I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I'm just going to give you some hand motions to help you wander through the week this week. So, creation, okay? So, why don't you stand up and do this? Listen to them. And the people moaned at Moses. You know, the Hebrew word for moan is loon. Onomatopoeia word. It sounds like what it is. They were loony, loony, loony. Okay, creation. And then what happens? Fall. Hey, pretty good. You're already up to Genesis 5. Oh, look at you. Good. And then what happened? Flood. Okay. So we've got creation, fall, flood. And then nations are scattered. Tower of Babel. Okay. So we come to the patriarchs here, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Okay? So creation, fall, flood, nations, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Just do that with your neighbor real quick. Okay, now, the book you've just finished, the book of Genesis, you've covered 50 chapters of the Bible, okay? Now, the people, when Genesis closes, what happens? Oh, look at you sitting down, you sleepy. Okay, you can go on and sit down. That's fine. We'll work our way through this. Okay, when Genesis closes, Joseph is, we've gone through the Joseph narratives in Genesis 36 through 50, and they're down in Egypt. They go down to Egypt, and they're in bondage. How long were they in bondage? 400 years of bondage. Okay? So that's where we are right there. 400 years of bondage in Egypt. Now, let me give you books. Job is the oldest book in the Bible. Genesis is also an old book, but it goes with Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Pentateuch, five books. Pentateuch is five, and Pentateuch is scrolls. Conservative scholars believe they're written by Moses. Liberal scholars believe they're written over a series of years and different authors and different campfires in history. So they actually put together, I read all sides of different arguments, but the liberals put together a Bible called the Complutensian Polyglot. And so what they did is, from their views of Genesis, because they see different generations writing different pieces, you know, the priestly piece or the Elohim piece or the Yahweh piece. And so they color-coded all the different time periods, and they put it together in the Complutensian Polyglot. And so when you read Genesis, every word is a different color because it comes from a different time period and a different author and a different place. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Now, tell me, really, which takes more faith? To believe that God wrote through Moses, one man at one time, or to believe that he wrote through 50 to 60 people over a 2,000 year period, and they all put it together and it worked?
Right.
Now, I'm going for the simple faith one back here. I take Moses as the author of the Pentateuch. So. But that's here or there. That's a German hypothesis of the 1800s. Graf Wellhausen came in and they bought into Darwinism, except they put it in the religious field. And that's got into the German schools in Europe, and then it came to the American schools because we went to Europe. And then we ended up with what we call liberal theology. So. Which means they don't believe the Bible's true. It's just a moral book. I believe that the Bible is God's inspired word, and it is inerrant in the autographs, and I make no apologies for that. And if you want to argue about it, we can put manuscript data together to prove it. Okay, another story. So, Egypt, 400 years, Germany, 400 years, bond is just bad, it's bad, this is brick, straw, mud. You saw Charlton Heston in this. Okay, so come on, 400 years bondage. And then who did they raise up?
Moses.
There you go, Ramon. Most people go, Moses. People are not going to follow Moses. Moses. Okay, so 400 years bondage, Moses. And then what happened? They ended up wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. Okay, so here we go. Exodus, we got the wandering years. 1446 is the early date for the Exodus. A late date would be 1290. We believe in the early date because of 1 Kings 6:1 tells us that it happened before Solomon's rule here, 400 and something years. So Exodus advances the narrative of the children in Egypt and their troubles. Leviticus deals with the priests. See Levite in there? This is a priestly manual, and if you say, I'm going to read through the Bible in a year, Genesis, Exodus, you do okay. A lot of drama here, a lot of drama here. Then you get to Leviticus, and you start ripping wings off and burning entrails, and they go up in smoke, and after about six chapters of this, you're done. You're like, nah. Leviticus will kill you off if you don't know what to look for in there, but that's another one. Numbers moves forward. Deuteronomy, that's Deut means Sue. And nomos means law. Deuteronomy is the Mosaic law given to the generation that's getting ready to enter the land. Because they've been in bondage those 400 years. And so there's some different changes that relate specifically to Joshua and Caleb who will lead them into the land. So 40 years of wandering, enter the land. Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. Okay? So let's go from the top. That's under Joshua and his buddy. Those I've taught before know who Joshua's buddy is. Who's Joshua's buddy?
Caleb.
Caleb, which means what?
Dog
in Hebrew. I just love it. I mean, how many of you saw Big Jake with John Wayne? You know, he's riding his horse out there with the Duke. And then some guy's giving him grief and he just yells, dog. And this big old black dog comes out and just jumps all over everybody. And I'm sitting there watching Joshua and Caleb come walking up to Moses. And got the 10 other guys there and they're all doing it. The Bible says, the Hebrew says they're doing a whispering. Have you ever heard people whispering and you walk up and they stop?
Yeah,
well, that's what's going on because they're spies and they're like, it's too big, it's too big. And Joshua comes up and he says, we can take that hill. We can take that hill in power of God himself. And his buddy next to him is going, and the other guy's going, anyway, I love the Old Testament, okay, the Hebrew scriptures. So, you see my Sea of Galilee, my Jordan River, and then my Dead Sea? Okay. Yeah, a little bit there. Then we got to move on to the time of the judges. Got to get moving here. Exodus conquest, there we go. We've got after the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, we've got 7 cycles of judges. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. United Kingdom. See? S-D-S. S-D-S. Saul, David, Solomon. And how long did each of them rule?
40.
That's the United Kingdom. This is where, if I had my sandals with me tonight, I'd hold up one sandal, my first sandal, and on the bottom of it, I would have the name Saul written. And then I would hold my second sandal up, and I have the name David written on it. So first sandal is Saul, and second sandal is David. You call them Samuel, I call them sandals. So that's how I remember it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mervin, very nice. So first sandal is Saul, second sandal is David, and then we'll meet to the kings. That's where we're headed next. My little puncher out here. At the end of Solomon's rule, King starts about right here at the end of David's rule. And so you see 1 Samuel 8 and following to 2 Samuel, 1 Kings 1 through 11. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and that's Song of Solomon. 931, Solomon will die and his kingdom will be passed on to one of his sons. And so this is going to be where we're going to be tonight. In this period right here with the succession narratives beginning in 1 Kings that go from David's death to Solomon's ascension to his death. And then the kingdom will divide. 10 tribes will go north. 2 tribes will go south because there's 12 tribes of Israel. The 2 tribes in the south will be called Judah. The 10 tribes in the north will be called Israel. Anybody remember why the kingdom divided?
Taxes.
Not Texas, taxes. Okay. So let's do 7 cycles of judges. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. United Kingdom. 3 kings. S-D-S. Saul, David, Solomon. How long?
40.
Kingdom divides over taxes. Okay? 10 tribes north, 2 south, Israel,
Judah.
Okay, now with me for where we're going, kings in the north, 19, kings in the south, 20. Good kings in the north, 0. Good kings in the south, 8. So, kingdom divides. This is where we'll end this. Kingdom divides over taxes. Rehoboam splits the kingdom, one of Solomon's sons. Ecclesiastes, he's writing as an older man looking back, and he goes, who knows who will get your things after you die? You work your life.
You work in the earth and you work your whole life for something, and who knows if you leave it to a fool or a wise man. Well, guess what he got? Fool, 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 just like out of Gomer Pyle. Rehoboam got the kingdom. And so Rehoboam, in 931, he's the king over everything Solomon had, and he goes to the people, and he's looking around, he goes to the elders. He says, what should we do? And they said, back off the taxes, the people will follow you. Solomon was an oppressive taxer and conscripted people into the armies and made them go build things. He was not a great, nice guy. Did accomplish a lot, but he was oppressive. And so the elders said, back off. It's kind of like a tea party, probably. So they said, we've taxed enough already. So back off, the elders. Then he goes to Rehoboam, who's young, goes to his buddies. This is like going to your teenage friends. Hey, folks, easy, whoa, what do we do here now? And they go, yo, yo, let's tax them more. And he comes back and he goes, whoa, yo, yo, we're going to tax you more. And then a fellow named Jeroboam says, well, so be it, but we're leaving. Kingdom divides, splits the thing right in half. Well, two-thirds. Two go south, Judah and Benjamin. The other 10 tribes go north and form the northern alliance called Israel. They will have 19 kings. This Judah will have, or this land will have 20. There will be no good kings in the north in the sense of calling the people back to covenant and obedience. We're going to meet people up here like Ahab, Jezebel, Athaliah, these nasty, nasty people that are really bad. I thought Jezebel was bad in the Bible. You know, she's Ahab's wife and she wanted to destroy Elijah and oh, she's so wicked. She's just a nasty, wicked city slicker woman. And then I read about Athaliah. Athaliah killed her grandchildren to try to accede to the throne. I thought, whoa, now that is cold-blooded. You know, we're talking about Truman Capote kind of killing here. So anyway, but this is what's going on in the north. God is still working up here, and he sends different prophets. Elijah and Elisha will be the two that you know the most of. Hosea and Amos go north too. Jonah goes to Nineveh. Nahum goes to Nineveh also. And in the southern kingdom, he'll send a whole series of prophets, Joel, Isaiah, Micah, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Lamentations, to these kings to listen to him. Some will, some won't. In the south, eight will listen and try to call the people back to the Lord. So you see, the northern kingdom falls in 722 to the nation of Assyria. Sennacherib will come in. Sargon the fifth comes in, and Sennacherib comes in 721. They conquer this northern kingdom and take the people into exile, and that leaves the two tribes in the south for another 150 years. But they extend because they had eight kings that followed the Lord, so they lasted a little bit longer. But eventually, they too fall, and Babylon will come in and destroy Israel or Jerusalem in 586. The temple will be decimated, and they'll go into a 70-year Babylonian captivity here. And then they'll come back from that at the end under Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel. So you can find that on your handouts. So let's go to Kings. Open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 1 tonight. Well, let me just read the analytical outline to you. The introduction to 1 and 2 Kings looks like this. With the analytical outline after it. So this gives us a little background here for what's going on. Like the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, remember 1 Samuel was Saul, 2 Samuel was David. The two books of Kings were originally one book in the Hebrew Bible. The original book was Malachim, or Kings, taken from the first word in 1:1, now King, so forth. So Malachim means King. The LXX, now that means, anybody recognize how many that is in a Roman numeral?
70.
There you go. Close, Bob. We're not quite there yet. So it's 70, and it's called the Septuagint. The Septuagint, the LXX, was the first Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible in 250 B.C., So Jesus is born in 4 B.C. He was not born in the year 0.
Herod the Great was still alive, and he died in 4 B.C., so he has to be able to kill the children in Bethlehem. But that's chronologies, and I hate numbers. Okay, so in Egypt, Alexandria, Egypt, in 250 B.C., 70 Jewish scholars were brought together. Thus, we get the LXX, the 70. And they translated the Babylonian Talmud and the Jewish Talmud and some of the other Talmuds in the Hebrew Bible into Greek, which was the lingua franca of the day, the common language. So in 250 B.C., the Septuagint comes in. That becomes the Greek Old Testament for people. It was certainly in use in the time of Jesus, along with Hebrew too, but that's kind of the primary deal, because Alexander the Great had conquered the world and made Greek the language of all the nations. Alexander the Great, that's the one white page between Malachi, the Italian prophet, and Matthew. That one white page is the intertestamental history. It's 400 years. The synagogues arise, the Pharisees arise. Alexander the Great has conquered the world. Greek becomes the lingua franca. Rome has come to power. All kinds of things in that one white page. So when Matthew opens up, all this stuff's taking place, and we just go from, oh, there's going to be a child born to you, and it shows up on all the Hallmark cards, Micah 3:5, and then we're into Matthew, and you don't know what happened in that, in all those years. You got Pharisees, and you got communes, you got Qumran, you got all kinds of things going on there. So that Bible, the Septuagint, became one of the main sources there. And so we know we had a Hebrew canon by at least 250 B.C. So that's 250 years before Christ. We had a solidified agreement that this was God's Word in the Old Testament. Now the manuscripts we used, no, I'm not even going there. That's a whole other discussion. But I can talk about the Masoretic text in AD 900, but we're not going there. So one of the suggested purposes of this division in Kings has been the fact that the Greek language requires more scroll space than that of Hebrew. So if you have never read Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict about how the scribes put together the Old Testament and how they wrote it, they were basically Xeroxers of the ancient world, one letter at a time being prompted by a prompter, and they watched as they would write the letters. And when we took, just a moment, when we took the manuscripts of 250 B.C., there's a whole other group of manuscripts in A.D. 900, Hebrew manuscripts called the Masoretic text, okay? They found the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947, and they took the Dead Sea Scrolls and they compared the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are A.D. 100 B.C., to the time of Christ, Qumran community. They took those scrolls and compared them to the AD 900. So we're talking 800, 900 years difference between the two scrolls. Are you understanding what I'm saying? There was less than a 2% variation. And these are handwritten Hebrew texts to show you the care of the scribes. And the New Testament's even more impressive in manuscript evidence. The earliest New Testament document we have is AD 125, the John Rylands Papyri. The last book was written A.D. 90, so we got a 25-year gap between that and the first extant manuscript. And the first century there, we've got probably a couple of hundred, 200. By the third century, there's 4,000 manuscripts of Greek to compare with each other. This is what scholars do. They sit around and look at these things. But the point is this. Aristotle wrote in 1100, he wrote in 1100, 700-year gap. The most manuscripts we have of Aristotle or Sophocles or Tacitus, 5 or 6. So from the time they wrote till the time we have a manuscript is 700, 800 years, 1500 years with 6 manuscripts. New Testament, 25 to 100 years, 300 to 4,000 manuscripts, and somebody says the Bible's not reliable. Seriously, you just really got to get some intellectual honesty. You at least have to say it's a lot more plausible that with those manuscripts you can come back to the original. And that's what scholars do. Excuse me, that's what the LXX brought out. The author of Kings is unknown. Jewish tradition and the Talmud suggests the Kings was written by Jeremiah. The style is similar. The phrase "to this day" is used. Others, I'll just say there's a number of people that think maybe it's a compilation, but they do believe the divine inspiration of the Spirit was used by these individuals to put it together. The setting, the inclusive dates are from the death of David, 970, till the captivity and release of Jehoiachin. Now, you're going to meet a lot of folks in these lines of things, Jehoiachin, Jehoiakim, Jehoiahoiah. And it's all, it's really kind of exciting. And then you're going to meet Zedekiah. He's pretty cool too, except he sees his sons die and he gets his eyes plucked out by the Babylonians on the plains of Riblah, but bad ending. So the emphasis here is we've got 387 years Solomon to the destruction of the temple is kind of the heart of the thing here. The purpose of the books is to continue the history of the kingdom, which was instituted by Samuel from the time of the coronation of Solomon to the captivity in Babylon. The books detail the cause of the decline from glory under Solomon until its demise in captivity. So the theme is the glory and division of Israel and Judah. Now, the book gives you, these are just some random thoughts I've scribbled down today. King shows us why the nation fell from prosperity to conquest to exile, and they lost all the land that Joshua had conquered and was organized under 1 and 2 Samuel. So it's going to show the decline of the nation. Now let me make a comment here. Israel had a covenant relationship with the Lord. When they came out under Passover and they agreed at Exodus 19, 6 through 8, Moses came from the mountain and said, "Will you be the people of God? Will he be your king? And will you agree?" And they said, "Yes." So they entered into that covenant relationship, but they were already a redeemed group of people because they'd come out under Passover blood by the time they got to Mount Sinai, escaped from the Egyptians. So we're talking about people that were already believers. So believers entered into that covenant relationship with the Lord called Mosaic Law, 613 precepts, 363 of them are negative, the rest of them are positive, which kind of gives you a clue that it's not going to turn out so well. But that relationship is unique to the nation of Israel. And then when Jesus comes, that covenant is nullified by his blood of the new covenant. So we're no longer under, Israel's no longer under that law because we now have something new called the church where Jew and Gentile become one from the day of Pentecost forward. So we are under new covenant now in our day and age. We're not under the law. So I want to make those distinctions clear. Israel had a covenant relationship. God was their master. They were his servants. It's a suzerain vassal treaty, a king-servant treaty of the ancient Near East. And they said, "We'll obey." And he says, "If you obey, you will be blessed in your fields, in your homes, in your prosperity, your crops, your kids, your wives. You'll have babies everywhere. The rain will come. The crops will flow. It's all material prosperity if they would obey the law. But if you don't, bound will you be in your wombs. Bound will your children be. And eventually we'll take you into exile to discipline you till you come back to the Lord." Now, that's the nation of Israel. I want to make that clear. The United States is not the nation of Israel in a covenant relationship with God. Are you understanding me? Because so many people draw that parallel today. However, our nation, in general, I'm not going to argue that point, was founded on Judeo-Christian ethics, or at least it had a lot of believers involved in it. How many of you remember what Australia was started with?
Convicts.
Convicts from where? Britain. Okay, so that's why we've got, "Oh, throw a shrimp on the barbie, baby, down there. Let's have a fight and a rumble over the whole thing." And then up here we go, "Oh, let's have Thanksgiving and get along." You know, there's a difference in the founding of the nations, and it has affected us. We've only been around 200 years. We are not a long-lasting nation. Okay, so we're not Israel, but we were founded on principles that respected a creator and morality. What I see as a parallel, and I'm trying to make this clear, we're not Israel, But when I look at the kings and Samuel, I see a nation that's called to God, and when they move away from that to self-interest, they begin to disintegrate. And we're going to see it throughout the kings. But do not mistake, we're not in that covenant relationship. But I do believe you reap what you sow. So, let me just give you a few random thoughts about some governments in the book of Kings, and then we'll look at the text for a few minutes. Solomon's government was oppressive and had taxes unbelievable. They conscripted people into the government service. These are not in the notes, these are just my thoughts. However, he had beautiful temples. Everything was magnificent. The state was more important than the people, and eventually the people got tired of it. So that's when Rehoboam said, "What should we do?" And they said, "Tax them more." And the people said, "We're done. We are out of here." 10 tribes go north, 931 BC, under Jeroboam. Jeroboam says, "No, we're not doing it. We're out of here." So you see, the oppressiveness and the taxes finally got to them. Then Rehoboam follows. He has a whole new method, autocracy. He's going to rule with an iron thumb. He's going to put the second of Judah underneath his thumb, and they're going to do everything he says. Almost a dictatorship. He tightens his grip on control. He didn't trust God. The result will be failure and revolution and the division of the kingdom. Jeroboam will be another king along the way. He's going to try something called democracy. Okay? Now, let me make a point here. Joe, you can help me if I'm wrong. We have a constitutional republic in our country. It's not a democracy. Okay? And that's a fine point, but you need to know it. A democracy is the people having a say in things. And so Jeroboam backs off the taxes, and he lets the people, basically, leaves them alone. And they actually prosper under that. Now, I'm kind of looking at history, and I'm kind of going, huh, does this sound familiar? I mean, maybe I'm just nuts, but anyway. Israel's success, they have great success, and then they forget about God, and then they get selfish. The result is people can't govern themselves effectively without a moral compass. If you take God out of the equation, in the history of Israel, the times that they remove God from the equation, they degenerate and they self-destruct. And I do believe there is a moral principle there that if morality and the compass of right and wrong is removed from a society and everybody does what they want in their own eyes and everything's okay, there will be a reaping of the whirlwind with that. And Romans says this. It talks about men beginning to worship themselves in Romans 1. They turn away from God, and they worship not the creation and the Creator, but themselves. Humanism. And then in Romans 1, from humanism, 1:18, it says God gave them over to, there's three giving overs in Romans 1, to their minds to depraved thinking, their bodies to sexual immorality, and then he gives them all over to different their own basic lust, and they self-destruct. And then in Romans, he says, after that three giving overs, you worship God, you reject God, you worship yourself, God gives them over, he gives them over. In other words, your free will. He gives them over, he gives them over. And then it says, and they reaped the consequences of their actions. Full measure. Kind of scary, isn't it? So pray for revival. Be active in it. Let's take a look at 1 Kings 1. This is where it gets good. Got to meet the people. There's the kings of Judah, but you can't see it, and I couldn't get it on a chart, but I gave it to you. So here's David. Here's David's family. You have this as a visual in the back. Just want to point a couple of things out as we start here. Here's King David. Father was Jesse. And we got a bunch of other folks along the way here. But these are his wives that we've got recorded. We've got Michael, Saul's daughter. Remember, he came in dancing before the city and she made fun of him, and so it didn't turn out so well. And then we have Ahinoam, who has Ammon as a son. Abigail, Chileab. We're not sure what happened to Chileab. He's not in the narratives, and we're not sure that he was killed. There's question on that. Abigail is Nabal's widow. Abigail was quite a woman of her time. She went in to protect her husband because Hebrew term Nabal means fool. And David just asked for some provisions for his men who were protecting Nabal's property and Abigail's property. They were being raided by different tribes, and David and his men were protecting the property. And he said, "Just give us a few provisions, and we'll be on our way." And they said, Nabal says, "Get your own stuff." Well, that kind of ticked David off. Okay, so Abigail realizes, she goes, "Whoa, don't! The guy's helping us out." So she goes and intercedes for her foolish husband. He finds out, has anger management issues, and falls dead. So guess who gets the woman? And the property. The sea dew, the lake house, the home in Colorado, all that stuff. Just because he had anger issues. Oh, that's not Nabal, is it? That was my neighbor, I'm sorry. Micah. She'll have Absalom. Now, Absalom's going to be a key player early on here. Haggith will have Adonijah. Absalom's dead by the time we get to this book. Adonijah's who I'm looking for here. Adonijah, and then, let's see, where's the next one? Solomon are going to be key players in the opening of this. Remember Bathsheba?
Right.
Had the child in an adulterous relationship with the king, and that child died. Which I think in Samuel is one of the few places we may get an indication that children are in the presence of the Lord. Because the child is born and God says the child cannot live because he'll be a disgrace to the name of God. And so he dies. But David prays for the child for 7 days while it's still alive, and then it finally dies. And David then, remember what he does? He washes himself, he gets up, and he does what? Worships. Now that's not the response of a man who thought his child has gone to Sheol.
Right.
That's the response of a man who's trusting God with his children. So I personally believe the children are infants, or once fertilization takes place, those babies are taken care of by the Lord, but that's a whole other discussion. Okay. So for tonight's emphasis, Haggith with Adonijah, and Bathsheba with Solomon. So, let's meet David and see what's going on. Chapter 1, verse 1. Oops. There we go. Now, King David was old, advanced in age, and they covered him with clothes, but he could not keep warm. Anybody got a King James? Okay, Bobby, read me verse 1. Listen to this. This King James is precious.
King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him with clothes, but he got no heat.
He got no heat. That's what happens when you get old. I know, because my heat is not gatting like it used to gat.
Amen.
And we keep our house like a meat locker in the summer, and yet I turn on my little blanket. Jan's over there sweating, and I'm over here going, I realize I'm gacking no heat. Except David's 70 years old at this point. Okay? So the servant said to him, "Let them seek a young virgin for my lord the king, and let her attend to the king, and let him become his nurse, and let her lie in your bosom, that the king may keep warm." Now this was a medical practice. It's the tested to by Josephus in his Antiquities, Herodotus. Different Greek physicians talk about this. I'm sorry, Galen, not Herodotus. And so they would bring an individual to come in and sleep with the king, and he would be okay with the body heat. When I was growing up in the 60s, in those rebellious years, we had three-dog night. So You remember one dog night was cold, two dog night was colder, and the three dog night's about as cold as it's going to get. So you have three dogs in bed with you to try to keep you warm. I don't know what you do about the fleas, but anyway, they brought this lady, and here she is. Verse 3, so they searched for a beautiful girl throughout the territory of Israel, and they found Abishag, the Shunammite, from the town of Shunem, just 7 miles northwest of Nazareth, not far from there. And they brought her to the king. And the girl was very beautiful, and she became the king's nurse, and she served him, but the king did not cohabit with her. So he didn't have sexual relations with her. And the point of that, them making that point about the king, is David had been a young man with great vigor and stamina. And it's showing us that he's in total decline here at this point. He's running out of gas. He's running out of years. He's just running. They did not have two people in a commercial with bathtubs in the woods. Okay? Hold on. Well, he had a harem, but I guess this is just something they decided they would find a younger woman for him. She becomes wife status. Yeah, by staying with him, she is a wife even though she doesn't have relations with him. She takes harem status because later we're going to see some shenanigans going on by Adonijah. So the girl was beautiful, and King James, read me into King James there for me there, Bob. This is so cool. Listen to it. No, just read the whole verse 4 for me.
And the damsel was very fair and cherished the king and ministered to him, but the king knew her not.
The damsel was fair and she ministered to him, but he knew her not. How come he didn't know her? She's lying in bed with him. Oh, it's a different kind of no. Oh, okay, I did. Don't you love it? Superfluity of naughtiness is also found in King James. Love it. So, verse 5, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king! Now, why do you think he thinks he can be king?
He's in line.
Okay, these three are gone.
Yeah, he's in line.
So he's what?
He's number one.
He's oldest. And, you know, in the Bible, always the oldest is the one that rules, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Think about that.
Sometimes.
Jacob and Esau, excuse me. The older will serve the younger.
Joseph.
Yeah, you're all going to bow down to me and worship him one day. Brothers didn't like that much. No, they didn't, but they did do that later. So anyway, he thinks he's next, so he prepares himself with chariots and 50 men. And his father, here's three suggested reasons for Adonijah's bad behavior. Notice, his father had never crossed him at any time asking him, why have you done so? He never disciplined his son. And Eli had the same problem with his two sons that ended up being killed outside the door of the tent of meeting in chapter 10. There's some good stuff in Numbers, and chapter 10 is good because the boys are having sex right outside the tabernacle. And bam, God smokes. So could be the first fire for the altar of incense, which I thought was kind of interesting. But that's all another book. That's back in the Samuels. Second thing that he had done, he was a very handsome man. Do pretty people get their way? Yeah. Well, I would not know the answer to that question. But I've seen my beautiful bride glide through a room and everybody faints. What can you say, you know? Third, he was born after Absalom. So he's now the oldest living son. So three reasons why Adonijah thinks I should be king. Now this is a human perspective. So he conferred with Joab. That's one of David's commanders, but he is a nasty bad man. The son of Zeruiah and Abiathar the priest. Abiathar, there are two priests here. Look at verse 8. But Zadok the priest. Okay, we got two priests here. And both of them have served David at different times. The problem is, Abiathar is from the line of Eli in the book of Samuel. And the line of Eli was, God promised, was going to be cut off. They were not to have any more dealings with the priesthood after his sons had been fornicators. So Abathar is serving, but he's not God's choice. So Zadok is going to be God's choice. So we've got Joab and Abathar joining with Adonijah. So Adonijah, and so they following Adonijah, they helped him. But Zadok the priest, verse 8, watch this dude. This dude is one bad dude in the Old Testament. There are some really cool people in the Old Testament. Benaniah is one of them. Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, keep that in mind because you're going to see him in a bit here. And he says that Nathan the prophet, you remember him, he's the one that confronted David, and Shimei, he was the guy that threw rocks at him and cursed him at one time. Seems like he's faithful at this point. Ray and the mighty men. I like this. The Hebrew term here is gabor, which means warriors. Remember there were those mighty men of David that nobody else wanted except David. And he took them and took this ragtag group and gave them a home, and they are following. They're faithful to him. And they belonged to David. They were not with Adonijah. So Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fatlings on the stone of Zoheleth, which is beside Ein Rogel, and he invited his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah and the king's servants. Now, the stone of Zoheleth is literally the serpent stone. So it's this large, curvy stone, and it's beside Ein Rogel. Ein is spring. And like Ein Gedi, the spring at Gedi, this is Ein Rogel, and this is why I have this map coming up here. This is the topography of Jerusalem. Key valleys, Hinnom Valley is here, this is north. Hinnom Valley is here, this is the valley of Gehenna, where a trash dump burned all the time, and thus became an imagery for hell, Gehenna, okay, over here. The Hinnom Valley is here. The central valley runs this way. This is the western hill. Kedron is here. Runs way up here. Mount of Olives is right up here. Okay? Ein Rogel is down here. So the stone, the serpent stone and Ein Rogel are down here. And this is where the party's taking place. But I want to point out the Gihon Spring. These are the two primary freshwater sources into Jerusalem. So we got the Gihon Spring here and Ein Rogel here, but Adonijah and his party are coming down here. Now let me ask you a question. If somebody's standing in one of these little valleys and they start talking a little too loud, who can hear what? It's going to echo either up or down in these valleys. Okay, just put that in your thinking. Again, this is geography coming into play. Hill of Ophel. Right here is going to be where King David's palace will be. See, this is where David's palace is. The Temple Mount will be expanded later at this point. But this is where the palace is, where King David is. So we got Ein Rogel down there, Spring of Gihon here, David's palace, and then Hezekiah's water tunnel that was cut through to protect him from invaders and comes out at the Pool of Siloam. Still a freshwater spring there today, except if you go down here, this is now called the city of Silvan over here, and it's inhabited by a whole bunch of Palestinians. And so when you go down here to the Spring of Gihon, you better be ready to move in pretty quick because they will throw rocks at you. I know. Okay, keep moving. So now we got verse 10, but he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaniah and the mighty men, and Solomon his brother. Then Nathan, okay, spoke to who? Bathsheba, saying, the mother of Solomon, saying, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become the king? And David, our Lord, does not know it? So now, come. These are imperatives. Come. Another imperative. Please, let me give you counsel. Third, save your life and the life of your son. Because if Adonijah becomes king, what do you think he will do? Same thing that Solomon is going to do, just like all most all monarchs did. They got rid of their adversary. Sounds kind of political, doesn't it? So go at once to King David, verse 13, and say to him, have you not, my lord, O king, sworn by your maidservant Surely Solomon will be king after me, and he will sit on my throne.
Why then has Adonijah become king?
And then in the Old Testament, if you're reading this in the Hebrew, you would see a little word called Hinena, or Hineni, but here it's Hinea, and it's behold is how it's translated. But it catches your eye because it's like in the New Testament, verily, verily, that means Jesus says, wake up. In the Old Testament, behold. It means you can read, but when you see behold, behold. Okay? Pay attention. While you are still speaking with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words. Now, why would Nathan come in after her and confirm the words? What did Deuteronomy require on legal matters? Two witnesses had to be there for legal matters. So Bathsheba went in, and the king in his bedroom. Now the king was very old, and Abishag the Shunammite was ministering to the king. Bathsheba bows. And the king says, what do you wish? And she said, my lord, you swore to your maidservant. Notice, we've got an oath here by the Lord your God. That's an oath to Yahweh. Personal covenant relationship there. And he says, surely your son Solomon will be king after me and sit on the throne. And now Adonijah is king, and you don't know it. And he has sacrificed oxen and fatlings and sheep in abundance and invited all the sons of the king and Abathar, the priest, and Joab, the commander of the army, but he has not invited Solomon, your servant. Talk about sibling rivalry. Talk about being excluded. Talk about being shunned. And so, now, for you, my lord, all the eyes of Israel are on you. Tell them who shall sit on your throne after you. So Adonijah is having what we would probably call a covenant feast. And the people are going to participate, and then he's going to want them to coronate him, to make him king. So he's throwing a big Barbie, Texas barbecue for everybody, except they wouldn't have pork, obviously. Not in the law. No rock badger, no lobster. Sorry about that. Just some things you just couldn't eat back then. And so otherwise, Solomon's going to be here. So verse 22, and while she was speaking with the king, Nathan the prophet came in, and they told the king, saying, here is Nathan the prophet, and he came in before me, prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And he said, my lord, the king, have you not said Adonijah will be king? For he's gone down and he says the same thing. In verse 26, he says, but even me and your servant, and Zadok the priest, and I wish I could do a Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada. I wish there was some way I could kind of reverberate. We talk about him. It's kind of like the movies when he goes, I am Batman. I am Benaniah. Bad dude. You're going to see him in a minute. So anyway, keep your eye on Benaniah. And your servant Solomon has not been invited. Verse 28, the king answered and said, call Bathsheba to me. And she came and stood in his presence. And the king vowed, as he said, an oath, as the Lord lives, I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. That's what this means. This is a Hebrew oath. As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, surely, as I vowed to you by the Lord. Now that's Yahweh, the God of Israel, saying, your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, and I will indeed do this day. A little background. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 14 through 16, God had promised David that one from his line would come to rule and reign one day. Oh, forever. He will have his throne forever. But it's going to come through the line of David, and David will be the one that chooses it, and it's called the Davidic Covenant. It is an expansion of a promise to Abraham in Genesis to have a seed. Now give me one moment. In Genesis 15, God promises Abraham a land, a seed, and a blessing. They are unconditional covenant or a treaty of covenant, depending on your viewpoint. You still end up in the same spot. They're unconditional, depending upon. They're in force as long as God's alive. Not Abraham. So how long will God live?
Eternally.
Well, that's going to be a little longer than you and me. But the land and the seed and the blessing. The land is marked off 1,500 miles from Jerusalem around the Mideast. That covers Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Libya. That land's going to belong to Israel one day. Do you think it's going to be soon? They're not going to give that land up without a little bit of a fight, and there will be a big one in Revelation 19. But then he also said, "You're from your line, Abraham, there's going to be a seed." And then in the time of David, Abraham's 2166, David's 970, he says, "From your line, the seed's going to come, and one from you is going to reign and rule over the throne of David." It's the Davidic covenant. So through David's line, and this is going to be Solomon on down and following, when Jesus is born in a backwater town, kind of like Lukenbach, Texas at the time, except it was called Bethlehem, it's a little bitty no-name place. Except it was the city of who? You mean 1,000 years later, 800 years later, God might actually have a baby born in the right spot? In the middle of nowhere, in the town of the city of David, the city Beit Lechem, the house of bread place, the city of David, that ties together the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7 and the line of Solomon that goes all the way back to Abraham, and one from that line is going to reign and rule one day. We're going to call him HaMashiach Yeshua, Jesus the Messiah, and he's going to rule over the land one day. But there was a problem. They crucified him. That's because we needed a sin substitute. And I'm telling you, if you don't know land, seed, and blessing in Genesis, the rest of the Bible will be a mystery to you forever. But once you get those keys, and this baby opens up and you're like, whoa, look at this. Whoa, I am almost a seminarian. No, please, please don't be one of them. I lived with them for many years. Thank you very much. Okay, let's see what happens here. Verse 32, David calls, "Call to me Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada." And they came, and so he tells them, "Take the servants of your Lord, my son Solomon, and my," look at this, "ride on my own mule." Now, this is interesting. If you were a king, would you ride a mule? Not me. I want one of those really big white horses. You know, something really cool. And besides, in Leviticus, you couldn't, Leviticus 19:19, there was a prohibition for crossbreeding. So these mules were brought in from other places. They weren't natural to Israel. But a king riding on a mule was a picture of a king saying, "I am a servant of the people." So it had imagery with it. Now, let me give you a little footnote here. Pardon me while I use all my Bible history up here. The donkey is the dumbest of all animals. I mean, it was viewed that way in the Mideast. If somebody says you're a donkey, that's the only thing worse would be a Gentile. And then you'd be a dog. And in the book of Numbers, chapters 22 through 26, we have a whole section called Balaam's Oracles. And Balaam wants to curse the nation of Israel. He hates them. And so he hires a prophet from Mesopotamia named Barak. And Barak wants to curse them. So he hires Balaam. Balaam comes over from Mesopotamia. This is the Jonathan Edwards of today, you know, the crossing over guy. He's the greatest prophet of the land, the smartest of all humans. He's coming from Mesopotamia. You know, that's where the gods reign and rule, the cities and the rivers, the Tigris, the Euphrates. And he comes to help curse Israel. And Balak says, "Go curse them, go curse them." And Balaam goes, and for four chapters he goes in there and he... Bless you. Bless the nation of Israel. He comes back, he goes, "Their God won't let me curse them. Their God will not let me curse them." So he gets on his donkey. And he starts to ride his donkey.
And what does the donkey see? He sees two angels with flaming swords, and the donkey squats down. Balaam, the most wise of all human beings, starts beating his donkey. And the dumbest of all animals in the world has more spiritual insight than the brightest human. You see, this mule thing has got a theme in the Old Testament. And the donkey doesn't say anything too terribly profound. He goes, haven't I been a good donkey? Why are you beating me? I mean, he doesn't go, stop it. He's like, I thought I'd been a pretty good donkey. And Balaam's talking, Balaam answers the donkey. That's like in the garden when Eve talks to the serpent, you know. Everybody goes, oh, yeah, she talked to the serpent. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of creepy. So anyway, Balaam, he knows how to get to the Israelites. He's not going to curse them because he realizes God won't let him curse them because he can't curse Abraham's seed unless God wants him cursed. So he goes back to Barak, and you know what he says before he leaves? He says, I can't curse them. I've tried for four chapters in this book to curse them. My donkey told me. My donkey had more spiritual insight than me. I'm going home. So you know what he tells Barak? He says, send in the Moabite women to the Israelite men. And the next chapter, bingo, hot chicks in Jerusalem. Hot pagan chicks. And there's some about a guy's eyes in his spiritual life that failed to connect most of the time. So guess what happened? Oh, and there was a big battle, and guess who gets killed in it? Balaam. Kind of sad, isn't he? Well, not really. He was a bad guy. He may have become a believer. We don't know. We'll wait till we get to glory. Verse 35. Let's see if we can tie some of this chapter 1 up. He says, you shall come up after him, and he shall come and sit on my throne and be a king in my place, for I have anointed him to be ruler over Israel and Judah. So, verse 38, Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaniah the son of Jehoiada, and the Cherethites, and the Pelethites went down with Solomon and had Solomon ride on the king David's mule and brought him to Gihon. See, we're at Gihon up here now. And so Zadok the priest took the oil from the tent or the tabernacle, anointed Solomon. So he pours oil, anointing the king. Then they blew the trumpet, and the people said, "Long live King Solomon!" And all the people went up after him, and they were playing flutes and rejoicing with great joy. And so the earth shook at their noise, and they're all right up here. Yahoo! Solomon rules! Rock on, baby! Yeah! What's going on down here? This is Adonijah's party. There we go. Verse 41. Now Adonijah heard all his and all the guests who were with him heard it as they finished eating. And Joab heard the sound of the trumpet. What's the uproar? What's going on? And while he was still speaking, verse 42, Jonathan, the son of Abathar, the priest, came in. He said, "Come in, for you are a valiant man. Bring good news." But Jonathan answered to Adonijah, No, our Lord, King David made Solomon king. This is a bad day at Ein Rogel. And this gets so cool right here. He says, so the king has sent him with him. He tells him who came with him. Verse 45, Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet have anointed the king in Gihon. They have come up from there rejoicing. So the city is in an uproar, the noise that you hear. Besides, Solomon has even taken his throne of the king, the seat on the throne of the king. So he's gone up to the king's palace and he's sitting on the throne already. So, verse 49, the guests of Adonijah were terrified. Well, yeah, because now a new king and you're seen in rebellion to the king, what are you thinking? You're going to lose your head. And so they were terrified and they arose and each one went his way. So Adonijah was afraid of Solomon. He arose and went to hold the horns of the altar. The only place he could seek refuge. I just love this section because they're all down there at Ein Rogel having this party. They hear all this noise from Gihon, and Jonathan comes in. He says, "Hey, guys, Solomon's the new king. He's sitting on the throne up there. And then everybody at the party goes, to the mules! We're out of here! You just see them all. Whoop, everybody is scattering throughout the country. So, and then Solomon finds out that he's taking the horns of the altar. And Solomon says, if he be a worthy man, and not one of his hairs will fall to the ground. But if his wickedness is found, then he will die. So Solomon, King Solomon, sent him, and they brought him down from the altar. And he came and prostrated himself before Solomon. And Solomon said to him, go to your house. So, now Adonijah is out of the throne. He's hidden on the horns of the altar. Now, let me make a note about the horns of the altar, because we're going to run into that next week. A manslayer could go to the horns of the altar in the cities of refuge and try to gain clemency.
You mean a murderer?
No. A manslayer would be like an accidental death.
Oh, okay.
Okay? A murderer could not.
Okay.
And I raise that point because next week we're going to see Joab try a similar thing. Joab had killed two of David's leaders, and one of them he killed in a city of Hebron, acting like he was his friend. The city of Hebron was a city of refuge, where you could go to flee from being killed if you had an accidental death. And so they're in the city in a time of peace, there's no war, and Joab kills this general. I'd have to look to see his name again. But he kills this general because this general had killed Joab's brother in a battle. But it was in a legitimate war where the brother was killed, but Joab held a grudge. And he says, here you are, my friend. And so he goes to hug one another, and he knifes him so bad that blood goes all over Joab's garments and his sandals. But see, he slayed a man in a city of refuge in a time of peace. This is the kind of general Joab is. He's a wicked man. And so David's remembering, and we'll see this next week in chapter 2. He's going to give a list to Solomon to be aware of. He's going to say, watch out for Adonijah, watch out for Joab, watch out for Shimei. Barzai was a good guy, he helped me, but you got to watch out for these guys because they're going to be looking out for you. So we'll pick it up in chapter 2 next week, but let me finish. We'll see if we can help the king here. As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, I'm going the way of all earth. Be strong, therefore, show yourself a man. Now that's kind of a strange little phrase. This is how the rabbis phrased it, which I thought was kind of interesting. In a place where there is no man, strive to be a man. Isn't that, that's kind of wisdom, isn't it?
Yeah.
When there's a lack of leaders, step in and be the leader. Or as we would say in Texas, man up. Or in the Old Testament, gird up your loins.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's lesson and encourage you to visit Grace Rock Ministries website at www.gracerockministries.org. Our website provides a variety of material to communicate the unchanging truths of God's Word, the Bible. While at the website, please consider donating in support of Grace Rock Ministries. Your donation helps us continue to get God's good news to our podcast listeners. Once again, that's www.gracerockministries.org. Thanks.